Yeah.
All time the record there.
Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was among the Kurus. There was a market town there called Kasasadama. The Venerable Ananda came to the Buddha, saluted him, sat down at one side, and said, before I get going too much further, this isn't Bhikkhu Bodhi's language. This is going to be a little bit different. This was translated by Maurice Walsh. It is wonderful, Lord. It is marvelous how profound the dependent origination is and how profound it appears. And yet it appears to me as clear as clear. Now, a little bit of background. Right after Ananda became a monk, he became a Sotapanna. And he was a Sotapanna for 20 years without the fruition. He just had the path knowledge. And then one day he was sitting in meditation and got the fruition knowledge. And that's why he's saying this, that it's as clear as clear. Do not say that, Ananda, do not say that. This dependent origination is profound and appears profound. It is through not understanding, not penetrating this Dhamma, that this generation has become tangled like a ball of string, covered as with a blight, tangled like coarse grass, unable to pass beyond states of woe, the ill destiny, ruin, and the round of death and birth. If, Ananda, you are asked, has aging and death a condition for existence? You should say yes. If asked what condition aging and death, you should answer, aging and death is conditioned by birth. What conditions birth? Habitual tendency conditions birth. Clinging conditions habitual tendency. Craving conditions clinging. Feeling conditions craving. Craving conditions.
Yeah.
Okay. Contact conditions
craving.
Mentality, materiality conditions.
Sixfold base.
Contact.
Yeah, it's not the sixfold base, it's contact.
Oh, it's contact.
Now, this is, I'll get to it in a minute. Consciousness conditions mentality, materiality. If asked, has consciousness a condition for its existence, you should say yes. If asked, what conditions consciousness, you should say mentality, materiality conditions consciousness. Now this only has 9 links in it, not 12. One of the things that he took out of this was the sixfold base. He took out formations, and then he took out ignorance. Thus, Ananda, mentality, materiality conditions consciousness, and consciousness conditions mentality, materiality. Mentality and materiality conditions contact. Contact conditions feeling. Feeling conditions
craving.
Craving conditions
clinging.
Clinging conditions
habitual tendency
conditions
birth
conditions
aging and death,
sorrow and lamentation,
pain and grief,
and despair. Thus, this whole mass of suffering comes into existence. I have said birth conditions, aging, and death. And this is the way that it should be understood. If, Ananda, there were no birth at all anywhere of anybody or anything, of devas to the deva state, and it goes through the yakas and the hungry ghosts, the humans, the quadrupeds, the birds, the reptile states. Didn't mention fish. That's odd. If there were absolutely no birth at all of all these beings, then with the absence of all birth, the cessation of birth, could aging and death appear?
No.
No, venerable sir. Therefore, Ananda, just this is the root, the cause, the origin, and the condition for aging and death, namely birth. I have said habitual tendency conditions birth. If there were absolutely no habitual tendency in the world of sense desires, would birth appear?
No, venerable sir.
Therefore, just this is the condition of birth, namely habitual tendency. Clinging conditions habitual tendency. If there were absolutely no clinging, sensuous clinging, clinging to views, to rites and rituals, to personality belief, could habitual tendency arise?
No.
Craving conditions clinging. If there were absolutely no craving for sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, tangibles, mind objects, could clinging appear?
No.
How much relief is there in that? Feeling conditions craving. If there were absolutely no feeling, feeling born of eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact, in the absence of all feeling, with the cessation of feeling, could craving appear? Therefore, Ananda, just this is the root, the cause, the origin, the condition for craving, namely feeling. And so, Ananda, feeling conditions craving, craving conditions seeking, seeking conditions acquisition, acquisition conditions decision making. Decision making conditions lustful desire. Lustful desire conditions attachment. Attachment conditions appropriation. Appropriation conditions avarice. Avarice conditions guarding of possessions. And because of guarding of possessions, there arise the taking up of stick, sword, quarrels, disputes, arguments, strife, abuse, lying, and all other evil, unskillful states. I have said, do you want to go over that again?
Yes.
I thought so.
It doesn't have bathtubs in there. I have a question here.
We have a question.
Yes.
I just wanted to know, what does avarice mean?
Greed, isn't it?
Greed. This was an Englishman. Got on some slack with their language. Okay, therefore, Ananda, just this is the root, the cause, the origin, the condition for craving, namely feelings. And so, Ananda, feeling conditions craving, craving conditions seeking, looking for, seeking conditions acquisitions, acquisition conditions decision making, decision-making conditions lustful desire. Lustful desire conditions attachment. Attachment conditions appropriation. Appropriation conditions greed. Greed conditions guarding of possessions. And because of guarding of possessions, there arise the taking up of a stick and sword, quarrels and disputes, arguments, strife, abuse, lying, and other unskillful states. I have said all these unskillful states arise because of the guarding of possessions. If there were absolutely no guarding of possessions, would there be any taking up of swords or sticks? No. Therefore, Ananda, the guarding of possessions is the root, the cause, the origin, the condition for all these evil, unskillful states. I have said greed conditions the guarding of possessions. Appropriation conditions greed. Attachment conditions appropriation. Lustful desire conditions attachment. Decision-making conditions lustful desire. Acquisition conditions decision-making. Seeking conditions acquisition. I have said craving conditions seeking. If there were no craving, would there be any seeking?
No.
Therefore, Ananda, craving is the root, the cause, the origin, and condition for all seeking. Okay, so I'm gonna reread a little bit of this again. Feeling conditions craving. Craving conditions seeking. Seeking conditions acquisition. Acquisition conditions decision making. Decision making conditions lustful desire. Lustful desire conditions attachment. Attachment conditions appropriation. Appropriation conditions greed. Greed conditions guarding of possessions. And because of the guarding of possessions, there arise the taking up of stick and sword, quarrels, disputes, arguments, strife, abuse, lying, and other unskillful states. I have said all these unskillful states arise because of guarding of possessions. For if there were absolutely no guarding of possessions, would there be the taking up of stick and sword? No, Venerable Sir. But therefore, Ananda, the guarding of possessions is the root, the cause, the origin, the condition for all of these evil and wholesome states. I have said greed conditions the guarding of possessions. Appropriation conditions greed. Attachment conditions appropriation. Lustful desire conditions attachment. Decision making conditions lustful desire. Acquisition conditions decision making. Seeking conditions acquisition. I have said craving conditions seeking. If there were no craving, would there be any seeking?
No.
Therefore, Ananda, craving is the root, the cause, the origin, the condition for all seeking. Thus, these two things become united in one by feeling. I have said contact conditions feeling. Therefore, contact is the root, the cause, the origin, the condition for feeling. Mentality, materiality conditions contact. By whatever get stuck sometimes. I don't understand. By whatever properties, features, signs, or indications of the mind factor is contact is conceived of, would there, in the absence of such properties pertaining to the mind factor, be manifest any grasping at the idea of the body factor? Boy, I didn't understand that one at all.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do it again. Mentality, materiality, conditions, contact.
Mm-hmm.
By whatever properties, features, signs, or indications the mind factor is conceived of, would there be, in the absence of such properties pertaining to the mind factor, be manifest any grasping at the idea of a body factor? Ah, no. Mind and body can't be, mentality, materiality can't be really separated.
No.
This is one of the things that was a major sticking point during the time of the Buddha. Because of practicing absorption concentration, mind gets stuck just on one mental object, and you don't notice body anymore. When the Buddha came along and said that they were attached, they were concomitant,
conjoined.
That's an easier word. that they were joined together and you can't separate them. This was a major sticking point. Because the Brahmins, they were just into developing mind.
That's right. Advaita.
Yes.
The Advaita.
Yeah.
That's why I suffered so much with my husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is a suffering point, I guarantee.
Totally denying the materiality there.
Yeah.
In recognizing the whole.
And that's really amazing because you can't have mind without body.
That's right. It
doesn't work.
Most simple things they couldn't get.
And they were very strongly attached to that. So when the Buddha came along and kept them together, one works with the other. You can't have one without the other. And when you start getting deep in your meditation, like you were telling me today, you see a thought arise and then you see a pain arise in your body.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might see a pain arise in your body and six are it and all the thoughts let go. They are intimately involved with each other. They can't be separated.
Is the Nama Rupa connection the base for him yoking together Samatha Vipassana?
The base for that.
Is it the ground which you tried to do that? Does that need to do that? Or?
No, not really. Not to my understanding, anyway. Because of.
But doesn't it make sense? Wasn't the problem all samatha, and then you ended up with Advaita, and if you're you lose the other side.
The samatha, the way the Buddha taught it, it wasn't the problem at all.
Right.
But I can see where you're going with that, and you might consider it for a little while before I say anything.
Yeah, I see it too. Yeah.
They just didn't practice enough mindfulness to corpses. There they get it. Yeah.
Or do the foulness of the body meditation. Or do the foulness of the body meditate?
That's even worse.
But what the Buddha did on the night of his enlightenment was add that extra step of relaxing. Mm-hmm. And that changed the entire meditation. It couldn't go so deep as to suppress anything. You couldn't make your attention stay just on one thing when you add that relaxed step. It's like you don't have the relaxed step, your mind just points and just stays on that point. When you add the relaxed step, what you do is you start broadening your horizons, as it were. You start developing peripheral vision. So you can see when hindrance start to arise and you can let it go. You can see all of these things. The thing that really draws me to Buddhism is the absolute lack of suppression of anything. There is no suppression. When you six are, you're not suppressing anything. You're allowing the space for whatever that hindrance is to be. But you're not keeping your attention on it. And by not keeping your attention on it and relaxing into that and bringing up a wholesome object, you have a brief moment of relief, of pure mind. And you keep bringing that pure mind back to your object of meditation. So the hindrance, because it doesn't have anything pushing against it, I don't like it, I want it to stop, it pushes back stronger. This is what happens when people have things like depression. They have a painful feeling arise, and I don't like it. Craving arises. And then your story about why you don't like it, and your habitual tendency of always trying to think the feeling away. But thoughts are one thing and feelings are something else.
Objectifying again.
So you wind up with that feeling because you're trying to control it with your thoughts. You wind up making that feeling bigger and more intense until finally you say, I can't stand it. I've been depressed for weeks on end. I'm going to the doctor. I'm going to take some medicine. That dulls you out. That makes you unaware and causes all kinds of other problems with the side effects and that sort of thing. It's really not a good thing. So when you start practicing by adding that extra step of relaxing, you're not trying to control the feeling. The feeling can stay there. It doesn't matter. But you don't keep your attention on it. So you see the feeling arise and then that craving right behind it, and you recognize that, and you start to get into your thinking. And concepts and opinions and ideas and the story. And you get into that habit of trying to control all of that with your mind, with your thoughts. Now, we've been doing this from time immemorial. Until you come to this retreat. Until the Buddha came around to show us that there is no separation between mind and body.
Mind and?
Body.
Yes.
And you need to be able to recognize what's happening in both. When I first had the insight that a thought caused tension to arise in your body, when I first saw that, that was such an oh wow. It was just, I couldn't believe it. I'd see a thought start to arise and I'd see a tension somewhere in my body. Wow. Or I would do something, you know, I'd do a little owie of some sort, and all of a sudden the thought's there. It was amazing to see that. Okay, I'll go on here. I'm going to read this one over again. Mentality and materiality, conditions, contact. Whatever properties, features, signs, or indications the mind factor is conceived of, would there be, in the absence of such properties pertaining to the mind factor, be manifest any grasping of an idea of the body factor? Or, in the absence of any such properties pertaining to the body factor, would there be any grasping at sensory reaction on the part of the mind factor? No. So, these are so intimately involved that you can't have one without the other. And this was such a big insight to me that I actually wound up watching that for a full day of how a thought would come up and I would feel a tension in my body somewhere. And then I started recognizing that tension in my head. Sometimes the tension in the head would take second fiddle to the tension that arose in the body. So you had to relax that part of your body before you could relax the tension in your head. So when you are sitting and all of a sudden you feel your hands tighten up or your shoulder tighten up or your back tighten up, that's the first thing you relax. And then you relax the tension and tightness. It can work the other way when you start to go deeper. And that is when you let go of the tension here in your head. Because you're going deep enough, there's a line that goes down your spine. And you can start relaxing those tensions in your body. By whatever properties the mind factor and the body factor are designated, in their absence there is there manifest any grasping at the idea or sensory reaction? And the answer is absolutely no. If there's no cause for the mentality, materiality to arise, it won't arise. As you go deeper in your meditation and you start to really sit with stillness, you can see these links. You can see even the potential for consciousness, but you have to have a very extraordinarily calm mind to be able to see the potential for consciousness to arise. What most people are able to see, they can see the contact. And then calm down and you start seeing the mentality, materiality, mind and body. But it's very, very difficult to see the consciousness, the potential.
Concentration, no, the so-called mindfulness or attentiveness has to be very subtle.
It is.
enormously to see that.
That's why I was saying that you have to sit with a very still mind for a period of time before you would even be able to recognize anything close to this. But some of you are
otherwise the breath is sometimes too strong or can interfere.
Well, this is going beyond being able to see the breath.
Yes.
When you get into neither perception nor non-perception, you don't notice that. But what I'm talking about now is that very, very subtle, exquisite stillness, and then being able to recognize how this arises. And with that, you start to have a dispassion. And when you have dispassion, then what's the next one? I can't
think.
Liberation.
No, it's not the liberation I'm talking about.
Cessation, you're talking about.
Disinterest.
That comes before dispassion.
Oh, does it? No. Yeah. Dispassion has to come first. Sorry. Yeah. Dispassion has to come first.
I think so.
Yeah. I don't care if it's that way in the book. Dispassion has to come first. You become dispassionate. And then you become kind of bored with the whole process. And then when you have this disinterest, there's a letting go, there's an opening, there's almost a relief that it really doesn't matter. And with that, you get into the cessation. It doesn't matter. And then the cessation occurs. You have to have that step of it doesn't matter, or you won't be able to attain Nibbana.
So as long as there's an interest, there's desire, there's movement.
There's a little movement, right.
And you
keep on. That is why this is so brilliant that the Buddha taught. Because you're into a state and there's a slight bit of movement or vibration, whatever you want to call it. And you keep relaxing and the vibration becomes less and less and less and less until you've relaxed so much the cessation occurs. It's kind of an interesting process when you get right down to it. But you can't be interested in it. You just have to watch it. That's what Wisdom's Eye is all about. Wisdom's Eye is the pure observation of the present moment.
Dispassion.
That's right.
And disinterested.
Dissociated.
Evolved.
With a mind, with a bear.
Stop.
I am.
But you can't look forward to it. Okay? There has to be just this. Oh, yeah, okay, there's that. And there it is again. Okay, wait, relax it again and relax it again. If there's even the slightest bit of wanting this to occur, it won't. This is why the development of Wisdom's Eye is so incredibly important. And every time you do the six R's, you are developing wisdom's eye. That's the clear observation without any distractions in it. Your mind is open, your mind is bright, your mind is very alert and agile. And you bring that mind, that wisdom's eye, to your object of meditation. This is why this particular meditation, you go through personality changes, because you're seeing how this stuff works. And you're starting to let go more and more and more. You can't have, I want it to happen today. Because that's the fastest way to make it stop. You can't have any enthusiasm to make it stop. You can't have any imbalance in your energy. Okay, all of your enlightenment factors have got to be in perfect balance. Perfect balance. In order to see the cessation of suffering. Now, some of you, I've been telling you to make ask a question of what do I need to do so that my mind will be more clear, or so things will be more clear, so we can have a perfect balance. And sometimes the answer comes, well, your mind needs to be a little more still, or sometimes it says your tranquility is a little bit out of balance. So you need to be able to ask the question of your intuition. What needs to happen here so that it can be more clear, so it can be more bright, so it can be more understandable? You're practicing seeing dependent origination. All of you are to one degree or another. And this is great. Because you're teaching yourself how this process, this mind-body process, actually does work. You're seeing for yourself that what the Buddha is showing us is real. You're seeing for yourself what it means to see the impersonal nature of everything that arises. Yes. This is a major insight. Because even the slightest little thing, like Sariputta, I want to see more. This is interesting. I want to see how it works. That little tiny desire stopped him from attaining Nibbana. Mm-hmm. Attaining Nibbana more quickly. Let's put it that way. So you've been pointing your mind in the direction of Nibbana, but then you have to let it be and let it happen by itself. The whole process of the meditation is allowing. Allowing whatever to be, to be. Let it go. Relax. Smile. Come back to your object of meditation. For some of you, your object of meditation is working with the enlightenment factors. Some of you, it's with the extreme balance of mind, with the equanimity. I mean, sitting and watching you, some of you come in to the interview is absolutely brilliant. hey, how are you doing?
Everything's good.
It's fine. What's new and exciting?
No.
It's just this balance is so it's so amazing. I mean, it's really, really a treat to be around you. So, get back to the sutta. Then Ananda, just this, namely mind and body, is the root, the cause, the origin and condition for all contact. I have said consciousness conditions body, mind and body. If consciousness were not to come into the mother's womb, would mind and body develop there?
No.
Or if consciousness, having entered the mother's wombs, were to be deflected, would body and mind come to birth in this life?
No.
And if consciousness of such a tender young being, boy or girl, were thus cut off, would mind and body grow, develop, and mature? Mm-hmm. Therefore, Ananda, just this, namely consciousness, is the root, the cause, the origin, and condition of mind and body. I have said mind and body conditions consciousness. If consciousness did not find a resting place in mind and body, would there subsequently be an arising and coming to be of birth, aging, death, and suffering?
No.
Therefore, Ananda, just this, namely mind and body, is the root, the cause, the origin, the condition for consciousness. Thus far, then, Ananda, we can trace birth and decay and death and falling into other states on being reborn. Thus far extends the way of designation. I should have brought my other book. It has a better translation. This is fumbling. Excuse me. Thus far is the sphere of understanding, thus far the round goes, as far as can be discerned in this life, namely to mind and body together with consciousness. In what ways, Ananda, do people explain the nature of the self? Some declare the self to be material and limited, saying myself is material and limited. Some declare it is material and unlimited. Some declare it to be immaterial and limited. Some declare it to be immaterial and unlimited. Saying myself is immaterial and unlimited.
Who? Can I ask a question about this? Do they mean like, is that the Brahman idea of like...
Yes, we were? Absolutely. Okay. But the Brahmins... They have a lot of... The Brahmin religion is not Hinduism. The Brahmin religion is Brahmanism. Mm. And Brahmanism encases a whole lot of different ideas. And some people think the self is this or the self is that, and they argue with each other and so forth, sort of thing. And they have different disciplines to show that what they're saying is right and what somebody else says is wrong. Whoever declares the self to be material and limited considers it to be so either now or in the next world, thinking, though it is not now, I shall acquire it there. That being so, that is all we need to say about the view of the self. The view of the self is material and limited. And the same applies to the other theories. So much, Ananda, for those pro-offer of explanations of the self. How is it with those who do not explain the nature of self? In what ways, Ananda, do people regard the self? They equate the self with feeling. Feeling is self, or feeling is not self. My self is impercipient. God. What does that mean?
I don't know.
Anybody? Impercipient?
It's probably not in the dictionary.
Impercipient.
Percipient of light means what?
Awareness. Maybe it means not awareness.
Yeah, not aware of itself.
See, another thing with this book, it has all these notes that you go to and you read them and it doesn't tell you anything. I should have brought my other book. I'm sorry. Feeling is not myself. But myself is not impercipient. It is of a nature to feel. Now I'm not going to do this anymore. This is because of the language. This is way too confusing. I will do it on another day with another translation, and it will be much more clear.
Other question?
Yes.
Those conditions that the Buddha described that were conditioned based on craving, and it goes through that whole list. I think there were 10 or something.
Oh, yeah, that's where craving leads.
And that was... Were those most... Those sounded like they were habitual tendencies.
Well, they were, and they had clinging involved with them, too.
Yeah. So, is that part of an expanded
It's just a way of showing how this one little tiny craving can get blown up into wars.
Well, I love the relationship. I mean,
yeah.
I can see that in... Well, little wars. Not that I go to big wars anymore, but go to little ones.
But the whole thing is, he was just showing how it builds if you don't have awareness of how it works. And that's what's happening in the world today. I mean, how much fighting is there in the world today, and what is the cause of it? Mm-hmm. It always comes back to craving and ignorance.
Yeah.
So what we want to do is develop a mind that is able to recognize how this process works so we don't get caught for it for as long a period of time. It's real important for us to be able to see in our own mind how craving works so we can recognize how it works with everybody else. So when we let go of the craving, we can show other people how to do that too. Now, I'm trying to get you to smile. I'm trying to get you to laugh. I'm trying to get you to have fun with the retreat while you're here. I'm a sneaky monk. Sorry, I gotta be sometimes. The reason I want you to do this is so that you see that the Buddha's path is all about having an uplifted mind.
Yeah.
It's about having a mind that doesn't get pulled down into the mud. It's about having a mind that stays uplifted and happy all the time. When you smile all the time, it improves your mindfulness immeasurably. Because you get used to having a smile in your mind, you can start seeing when it's not, and you start seeing the tension and tightness grow. And you see more and more how you cause your own suffering. And you let it go. If you can practice smiling and being happy with yourself, how much more will you affect the world around you? If somebody comes at you with a lot of anger or dissatisfaction, and you allow them the space to have that anger and dissatisfaction without reacting to it, acting like you always act, then you're giving that other person the space to change. It's easy to say. It's not easy to do, because people always like to come at you when you're a little bit distracted. Getcha. But the more you practice having this uplifted mind, the more you think and ponder on having a happy mind, the more your mind tends towards that. And when your mind tends towards having this happy mind, you feel really content with life and the suffering, and the letting go of the suffering, and the seeing that all of this stuff is impersonal. It's not you. It's not me. It's not mine. I am not this. And I know a lot of people want to develop having an uplifted mind, having a clear mind, having a bright mind. The more we can develop the wisdom's eye, the more content we can be with everything in life.
Excuse me. Sorry to interrupt. Is it the same with seeing things as they really are? Is the same thing with wisdom eye?
In a way, yes. If you're seeing things as they really are, you're not being attached to them. And you're seeing that they are part of the process. So there's not the reaction to a situation. The learning how to respond means being in the present moment with a clear mind that doesn't have craving in it. As we start to do this more and more, we are starting to experience Nibbana more and more. It's mundane. It's not going to last forever. But that is the path that leads to the complete cessation of all suffering. I know that they're being laymen and being a householder, you feel like you have responsibilities to family and whatever, and what happens if I become an arahat, thinking that that would not be necessarily a good thing. But you would find out what true compassion is when you become an arahat. The whole rest of your life will be spent showing other people how to be happy. You know, there's a when the Buddha was went out as a bodhisattva and he saw the different signs and came back and heard that he had a son, and he knew that that was going to be a fetter if he went in and grabbed his son. He knew that he couldn't leave, but he knew that he had something that he had to share that was not only with his son and his wife, but with all human beings and devas, all beings. He had something that was real special that he had to work towards. And I've heard criticism of some people saying the Buddha was really selfish because he left his wife and children. Well, his wife and children, they missed him, of course. But they didn't really suffer a whole lot. They lived in a palace. Yeah. They lived with a lot of other people around them that loved them very dearly. And Yasodhara, the Buddha's wife, she heard that the Buddha or the Bodhisattva was doing a particular kind of austerity practice, and she started practicing it the way he was practicing it. She heard that he was taking on the yellow robes, so she took off all of her jewelry and she took on the yellow robes. She heard that he was cutting down on the amount of food he was eating because that led to enlightenment. She tried the same thing. Not to such a degree, but she was aware of what he was doing all the time. She wasn't upset. Of course she missed him, but she wasn't so mad that she was going to do something bad. And Rahula grew up with cousins and other children that were born on the same day that he was. They bring him into the palace, so they grow up together. So it wasn't like he was abandoning and letting the wife, his wife, go out and work and support the child and herself. They were very rich. They had all the support. This was a good thing, not a bad thing. So it's really nice to have the understanding that the Buddha was being the most compassionate person in the world at that time, because he was willing to give up all of his personal happiness and well-being so he could go out and work and find out how to give it to everybody else. He was the most generous person ever because he had this huge amount of energy and he was giving it all the time. He was giving his understanding. He was showing people the way. I mean, he only slept 2 hours a night. The rest of the time he was with other beings. He was with other people. He didn't have much alone time. Now that's the height of compassion. And all of the people that learned how to become arahats, they had that same kind of compassion. It wasn't quite as big, but it was the same kind. And they went out and they started teaching everybody else. How do you think India, at the time, became Buddhist? It wasn't just from the Buddha. It was because all of the arahats went out and selflessly showed other people how to have an uplifted mind, to have a happy mind. There was extreme prosperity in the land because of that. I mean, now you consider yourself rich when you have this much money in the bank. Being rich during the time of the Buddha, because he was so much into teaching people generosity, you weren't measured, your wealth wasn't measured by how much you could hoard, it was by how much you could give. And what did they give? They gave food, they gave clothing, they gave medicine, they built places for people to stay. So anybody traveling, they didn't have to sleep out in a tent. They could sleep under a roof. All of these things happened during the time of the Buddha because of the Buddha. It's a lot different than things are right now. So what we want to do is begin to practice our generosity. And you practice your generosity by giving of yourself. You give kind speech, uplifting speech, speech that makes other people smile. You give your energy to help other people in whatever way you can. You continually see another person and they remind you to send loving and kind thoughts not only to them, but to everybody in the world. That's what that one sutta is all about. Develop your mind in this way. Oh, but he's not a good person. He doesn't do this the way he's supposed to do it. So? Can you love him anyway? That's the teaching of the Buddha. Okay, this talk has gone astray. So if you have any questions you want answered, yeah.
Today we talk a lot about consciousness. Can you define that actually? I'm trying to understand.
When your eye hits color and form, eye consciousness arises.
Yes.
So the consciousness goes into mind and body in the mother's womb, means?
Right? Of course.
Okay. That means?
It means what? You tell me. What does it mean? I mean, come on.
I'm asking you.
No. You tell me, what does it mean? When the consciousness goes into mind and body, what does that mean?
So it stops using all the...
And if there's no consciousness, what does that mean?
So if you don't see anything, you know, all your six senses come about. Is that right?
It means you're not alive.
There is no birth. Mm-hmm.
There is no birth if you don't have consciousness.
So consciousness goes into the mind and body in the womb means, so it's... That's where the starts there?
That's where the whole thing starts.
So that's what they say, that when the person dies, the consciousness moves to another. It's a consciousness.
Not the same consciousness. But consciousness does go from one existence to the next. Don't you see that you're arising in them? Being born and dying all the time? And what is it, the same consciousness you had? It's a different one. So they're kind of conjoined.
Concomitant.
There is no mid. There's no gap between that. Right?
Is there a gap for you?
I don't think so.
You're continually being born and dying. Is there a gap? course there is. They're separate, individual consciousnesses arising and passing away.
What I mean, Gavin, just go and do something and that kind of get what I mean.
I have no idea what that just meant.
you're talking about two different things. You're talking about being born, you know, dying and being born, and the consciousness leaving and consciousness coming into another being. But he's also talking to you about moment to moment, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. Consciousness is moving like that. See, and then Chitra, he's also talking about. Same thing. Okay, your question was about birth and death.
No, your question was, what is consciousness? Yeah. What is it? You tell me. You know. What is it? What is it?
I mean, if it is I, the color and the contact, so then the consciousness, right? So
what is that consciousness?
Could you say it was the awareness of the eye function in cognition, the awareness of the ear function in ear cognition?
Well, I mean, you understand that what you mean. You see that, and then the contact, so just, you see. Is that what it means? Like,
consciousness is conditioned by the certain things. By what arises. When I gets color and form, then I consciousness arises. That's how you would see it. When ear the sound hits the ear, then ear consciousness arises. What is consciousness?
Knowing that you saw something.
Okay.
So, I mean, you just know that you saw something, or you know that.
Well, do you know that you hear?
Yeah.
Do you know that you see?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not you. It's just this phenomena arising.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but I say I see, but
we have to talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, instead of the Buddha saying I, he said the Tathagata, but he's really meaning I. Because we've got to be able to communicate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is possible because the five aggregates come together in that interaction. Consciousness comes into being.
See, the thing that gets really tricky is that feeling, perception, and consciousness are conjoined. So when you're saying, the five aggregates are another way of saying mind and body. It's another way of saying nama rupa. When I hits color and form, I consciousness arises. Meaning of the three is I contact. With contact as condition, feeling arises. Now you have the perception and feeling and consciousness all together. Okay?
I remember one of the sutras said, what if consciousness comes because
it cognizes. That's the function of consciousness.
Okay.
It cognizes.
It cognizes.
What does it cognize?
It's a pain. We
no.
cognize feelings. Painful feelings.
No.
I do not think it is cognizing the feeling, but one of the sutta, I don't remember, it says something.
Okay, feeling, perception, and consciousness, friends, are these conjoined or disjoined? Is it possible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them? Feeling, perception, and consciousness, friends, these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it is impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. For what one feels, that one perceives. And what one perceives, that one cognizes. Can't do it separately. That's the problem with this. It gets really tricky. Okay, what does it cognize? It cognizes this is pleasant, this is painful. It cognizes this is neither painful nor pleasant. It cognizes. That's why consciousness is said. Wisdom and consciousness, friend, are these conjoined or disjoined? Wisdom and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it is impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference. So then the question comes up, what is the difference? Here is the answer. These states that are conjoined, not just disjoined, this is consciousness is to be developed and wisdom is to be developed and consciousness is to be fully understood. Mm-hmm. What is consciousness? Mm-hmm. Come on. You know the answer. I'm not going to tell you. What is consciousness? You know the function of it. You know how it works. What is it?
That is, you know, okay, if it is I, that all mine. If it is I, you're seeing that. You see the contact, the color and the formation, you see. That creates the consciousness. And
what is it?
Knowing that you see, because you just finished consciousness.
What is that?
Aware of it.
It's kind of like
you become aware of it.
Yeah.
But aware is kind of a weird mm-hmm. word to yeah. use because there's so many different definitions these days of it. Okay.
Doesn't it work better?
So what I hear in the question is confusing though. So there's a whole business of consciousness arising.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get her to answer her own question of what is consciousness.
No.
Well, and there's also, when I talk about consciousness coming into a body in order to be fully rebirth, which sounds like it's talking about something else, always the same word.
Yeah, exactly. When it comes to consciousness, eye consciousness, mind consciousness, and that part, I understand. Somebody touched you, so then you're conscious. You're conscious. That's your feeling, right? If somebody touched you, but what if the consciousness goes into the
a baby potential. Well, because it's one cell, right?
Permission.
It's not a body. It's one piece of DNA.
It's the potential that comes into the body.
Oh.
the potential of consciousness. So you can say that consciousness is there, but it's actually the potential, because there's no awareness at that time. That's why awareness is such a difficult word.
So you mentioned that when you have the free mind, that to look for the link of the potential.
You can possibly be able to see that potential, but it takes a very, very still mind.
So it's the same thing, like it can be mind, eye.
It's the potential. It doesn't become the full-blown consciousness until there are certain conditions for it to arise.
Contact.
Well, but that's the condition. The conditions are the eye and the color and form hitting so that that consciousness can arise.
Isn't it like you can feel heat? You know, like you could put a hot ember into your hand, but you can't feel it right now, but the potential's there for it to be felt.
There, that's kind of pretty good. That's pretty good. In a simple loop that's happening.
I mean, it's not there now. There's no heat there. But it could be there if contact hit the... It fired it off.
Right.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Well, it's the old... The match and the...
See?
Fire.
Actually, this is a very profound question because I think even among Buddhist teachers, there's a confusion about potential of consciousness and undifferentiated consciousness, because some teachers almost lean towards the Brahman.
Yeah.
Just a little touch. I mean, this is really where the crux of the teaching rests. And you lean one way and you become into the Brahman world of there's a consciousness that goes from body to body. I mean, it all goes down into it. Or you say there's a potential for consciousness, which means something different.
Yes.
And you get into the true Buddhist perspective.
Right.
So it's a very deep question.
This is not easy. To answer in a real clear way, because the word consciousness in a lot of times is used in different ways, meaning different things. But when we get right down to it, what is consciousness? We know the function of it, and we know how it arises. But what is it? It is the knowing, but it's the potential of knowing.
When
it comes into the womb.
Mm-hmm. Or even when it comes into your present moment.
Well, here.
The rest of the links are very clear, but I wasn't sure.
And actually, even the formations are the potential for these things to arise. They can arise because that is there. And if that formation is not there, then body, speech, and mind will not arise. So it has to be the potential for it to arise when it gets down in the lanes. Okay. So, anybody have any other lightweight questions?
Great potential here.
Let's share some air. May suffering ones be suffering free and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we have thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth give us and power us a mighty power to share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddhist dispensations.
Happiness.